You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Welcome to the Vanessa Tyson and Under Mod Show. Brian Callen has abdicated responsibility for his own podcast yet again. And so we're organizing a one-hour mutiny.
That's right.
It's not going to be longer than 1 hour because as soon as the kid were to walk back in here, we would instantly fold and fall to our knees and recognize his right to do whatever the hell he wants.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Round five of Tyson. Mm-hmm. I should also note that I am trying to get the other Tyson on this podcast, Michael.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Which
okay.
will then at that point we'll have 2/3 of the Holy Tyson Trinity. Mm-hmm. I'll just have to get the guy from Tyson Chicken on, and then
what about Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Oh, that's true. Actually,
come no, on, that's the Trinity.
That is really the Trinity. That okay. really is the Trinity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even like Tyson. Well. I don't know. I shouldn't.
Oh, yeah.
The chicken is is good, even if it is factory raised.
And, it's, you know, all sorts of antibiotics and problematic hormones, but whatever.
Whatever.
Details.
Anyway, so, we had emailed before, and, mm-hmm. you know, now that we've covered districting, the pressure is really off.
Thank goodness.
And we can talk about whatever the heck we want. But what I thought might be fun to talk about is narratives.
Sure.
Right? Narratives that are built around, you know, different parties and all of this sort of stuff. Because we got some feedback from a listener, and, you know, they basically said that it would be great if I would stop bringing up unions every time we talked about special interests. And I should clarify, because it's very easy to think that what my point is that, you know, unions are bad, or that, you know, it's some sort of libertarian perspective, which mm-hmm. I'm not really a libertarian. Mm-hmm. My point is just to say that as soon as we only talk about corporations, what ends up happening is that you're going to alienate Republican voters, libertarian voters, and all of that mm-hmm. stuff. And if we're going to have campaign finance reform, then we have to understand that this is an issue that affects all of us, regardless of what our political stance is.
Certainly.
So let's talk about narratives. Because you've talked before about how the two parties have much more in common than we realize.
Certainly. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, and I say this, my first job out of college, I was a fundraiser for Senator Boxer here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. right? Was the Barbara Boxer. She had she used to have a Boxer box because she's rather short. Mm-hmm. And so in order to make it up to the microphone, there was a little box that we'd keep with us that she could then stand up on to reach the microphone mm-hmm. After she would follow up like President Clinton or whomever. Now, one of the interesting things, however, was that we didn't actually make it, you know, in many cases to the inner city. Mm-hmm. We never did, right? I mean, now this is interesting because on the one hand, Barbara Boxer is arguably, you know, one of the top five most liberal senators in the United States Senate. She has long been a proponent of, you know, social justice, environmental action, and so on and so forth. But when it came to actual campaigning, mm-hmm. right, there was, you know, there was very little, if any, time spent in South Central Los Angeles, in mm-hmm. Compton, in Watts, in Boyle Heights, right, in East LA, you know, in these areas that are notably, you know, impoverished.
Wait, there's poor parts in Los Angeles? What?
There are many poor parts in Los Angeles. And what I, you know, one of the things that I noticed, and this is part of, part and parcel of what we see with money in politics, mm-hmm. is that the overwhelming amount of time, flexible mm-hmm. time, energy, what have you, even for liberal Democrats, goes to courting wealthy, you know, wealthy, disproportionately white donors, mm-hmm. right?
So it now, isn't part of it also that they take it for granted that people who are impoverished will vote Democrat if they vote?
I mean, I don't want to. I think the hard thing is that I don't necessarily want to project, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't say what exactly the mindset is of the candidate themselves. But I can tell you that it's, you know, really the finance aspect of campaigns. And this is, you know, this is true because, I mean, this was even prior to Citizens United. This was prior to McCain-Feingold. This was 1998. I'm mm-hmm. dating myself, whatever. But suffice it to say, right, that the MO, you know, and the people who seem to have the most clout in terms of making campaign decisions were always the finance people, the fundraisers, you know, that would decide the schedule. And then, you know, maybe we could set up something here, something there.
There might be space for policy or talking to the people or whatever.
And usually, generally speaking, fundraisers are the first hired, last fired, right? In terms of actually, you know, raising the money. So what we saw was a disproportionate prioritization of, you know, catering to wealthy donors. And I would argue at the expense of really empowering, you know, those poor and downtrodden.
Right.
Right. There was little time or energy spent in those enclaves. Now, were they necessarily taking for granted, you know, the votes of poor and impoverished? I'm not sure, because I'm not convinced that they were. I mean, they knew that the poor and impoverished were not necessarily going to vote Republican, right?
Right.
On average, especially if you're talking about, you know, racial minority communities. Mm-hmm. But that said, they also did not necessarily count upon those minorities to vote,
mm-hmm.
right? So what would happen was roughly about a month and a half before the election, there would be a huge registration push, right? But mind you, this, you know, the rest of the campaign had been going on, right, in some way, shape, or form in terms of fundraising for, you know, for the last 2 years.
Right.
Right. You know, it had been going on for this entire cycle. About a month and a half before, all of a sudden they're focused on registration. And, you know, 2 weeks before, like, or even 3 weeks before, they're focused on the get out the vote, you know, going door to door, precinct walking, and so on and so forth. But yeah, so there was maybe a month and a half where there was some attention to poor, impoverished voters. And this is for a liberal Democrats campaign, whereas, you know, 2 years and even more, really, years and years spent on raising money from wealthy white donors.
Well, and the other thing is, too, is that there's the push to get them out. But is there a push to engage with them or understand their issues? Or is it just getting them to show up because they're taking for granted that they will vote Democrat?
Was the push to engage? No.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. I wish I could say otherwise. You know, I sincerely do.
They're just hurting them and basically saying, show up to the polls, get out there. You don't want a Republican in there, blah, 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 blah.
So one example was in 1998, they had a big rally, like mm-hmm. a pep rally at Garfield High School in, you know, in East LA area. You know, disproportionately, you know, Latino electorate there, but it was a rally. It was a rah-rah rally. It wasn't necessarily talking about the, you know, the issues. It wasn't about, like, you know, interaction,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, there's, and that was basically the sum total of it. So, you can have a rally, that's great, but what about, like, you know, sustained interaction between communities and the people who ostensibly want to represent them? I didn't see that.
So even on a deeper level, though, that's not something that either party is really offering.
No.
Neither party is
no.
really offering actual engagement between the people and the candidate, any sort of real discussion of policy issues. You mm-hmm. know, one of the things that Brian and I have talked about, you know, off mic, we mm-hmm. have off mic conversations. And one of the uh-huh. things we've talked about is the fact that, you know, what ends up happening is that it's kind of like in an out burger, and not in a good way, in the sense that there is this menu that is presented to you. They, you know, the policy
Granted.
Wonks go off. They decide, okay, what are the platforms that are electable? What are the platforms that allow us to raise money? What mm-hmm. are the platforms? And then it's like, here are the two options. There's no shaping of the platform that happens, because there's no opportunity for people to admit that they were wrong, to incorporate new ideas, to say, oh, we thought we were going to do this, but actually we just heard this really great policy proposal from somewhere else, so now we're going to change our platform. The platform isn't really shaped. It's just sort of thrown out there, or sort of like, here you go, here
Certainly.
Are your two options.
Well, I mean, one thing I will say, though, is that, you know, for instance, while Barbara Boxer and, you know, this, I mean, the rally that I'm thinking of included Al Gore, who was then vice president, and a handful mm-hmm. of others, you know, and it was definitely kind of rah-rah. It wasn't, you know, an engagement of the issues. But at the same time, you know, I don't know that the Republicans have ever tried to hold a rally. you know.
They hold rallies.
Oh, no. I mean, at Garfield High School, like in East L.A.
But that's
right.
But they hold their rallies in, you know, Western Virginia. They hold their rallies in Kentucky.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Certainly. I'm not saying they don't hold rallies. I'm saying that they don't hold rallies. They make absolutely no effort, from what I've seen, at least in California, to, you know, actively, you know, engage or to actively outreach to African-American and Latino voters.
But by the same token, Democrats don't make any real effort to actively engage with the Republican base.
Granted.
Right.
Granted. But what I would argue, though, is that, you know, the lack of diversity within the Republican Party is still a very high, I find it highly problematic.
Well, but there's also a lack of intellectual diversity in the Democratic Party. And, let me pitch you a scenario.
Okay. Right? Pitch me a scenario.
So, you know, in the Byzantine Empire, mm-hmm. there, you know, they would go to the Hippodrome, and they had these two, there were two main racing teams. There were the Blues and the Greens. Mm-hmm. And the Blues and the Greens, you know, there were traditional supporters of the Blues. Generally, it was people who were involved in the maritime trade, people who were fishermen, people who were all these things. Mm-hmm. And then there were the Greens, and mostly mm-hmm. that was people who were, worked the land, who were involved in the agricultural side and all that sort of stuff.
Certainly.
And people get really fired up. Blues versus Greens. Blues mm-hmm. versus Greens. Of course, there's not much practical difference. They're both racing chariots. And,
yeah.
you know, you have whoever your horse is and whoever your charioteer is versus whoever their horse is and whoever their charioteer is. But the conflict between the Blues and the Greens got so emotional and so intense that there were riots. You know, mm-hmm. it was a repeated issue of, you know, these people would kill each other over blue versus green. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether what we have currently with the Republican and the Democratic Party is Blues versus Reds, and that it's not that much different because they've managed to carve out this Manichaean system of absolute good and absolute evil, right? Both of them have a situation where our guys are the gods mm-hmm. and their guys are the devils. Mm-hmm. And you have to make sure that the devils don't get into power, because if the devils get into power, then everything will fall apart. Mm-hmm. They're two basically cargo cults. There's not that much that's different between them.
Well, I agree. To a certain extent, right? You know, I mean, I've often compared, as have other political scientists, often compared these, the political parties to cartels, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, which they largely are, right? When you think about, like, kind of like how they curtail people to act, you know, according to their interests and so on and so forth. And these are institutions, right? These parties unto themselves, you know, though they have individual actors, are institutions, right? Mm-hmm. And these parties seem to, the leadership seems to be very focused on maintaining power, right? At whatever cost, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, I would say that's true of both parties on average, right? On average, you know, there are outliers and, you know, extraordinary circumstances, et cetera. What I would say, though, is that, you know, I think that becomes much more problematic given that we have such a diverse population here, right? Like, you know, you don't see, I mean, so what you see, I think that's definitely a case of the leadership,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't know, I mean, and you and I have talked about this off, that I'm much more concerned about the rank and file, right?
I agree.
And the kind of impact that these, you know, that various elections might have on the rank and files, particularly those, you know, groups that have been disproportionately excluded from the process and marginalized, right? And whether we're talking about racial minorities, whether we're talking, you know, ostensibly to a lesser percent with women, but you certainly see this, like, in terms of the ostracization of LGBT candidates, the poor in general, and poverties that, like, policies that would, you know, would address poverty, right? That's where we, you know, that tends to be much more where my concern is. But yes, these parties have narratives that, I mean, that are highly problematic and interesting how they cast themselves, only because in many cases it's completely contradictory of what they actually do.
Right. And in terms of those narratives, I think the interesting thing is, if you look at what the Republicans and their Democrats are saying, apparently every single issue can be solved either by more government or less government. There's never a situation in which there's something that has to be solved with something that doesn't involve government.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, with education, you know, the narrative is all about, you know, more government, less government, more government, less government.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, from my own work with students, you know, the problem is cultural. I mean, you know, the Republic of Vietnam has a per capita GDP less than the Republic of Congo, and they kicked our asses in the latest round of test scores.
Yeah.
Is that because of resources? Does every child in Vietnam have an iPad? Or is it that, you know, our beliefs about intelligence have gone so off course and gone so wrong? I mean, Pasi Sahlberg's book, Finnish Lessons, which I'm listening to right now, I mean, you know, there's a very different culture in Finland. That's a huge part of it. They respect teachers, you know, and those sorts of things, which, you know, can you legislate your way to respecting teachers, or do you need to change your attitude?
Well, I mean, I think it also depends on what you can, what you categorize as a public good, right? And I mean, so on the one hand, yes, do I mean, if you are, if the government is providing a service, i.e., you know, primary education, right, which I do think that the government should provide. I think every child should have, you know, the provided public service, right, then, you know, of education. What I think you can say is that, yes, there must be legislation involved, but I think that not all legislation is good, right? I mean, No Child Left Behind had, you know, it was deeply flawed, to put it mildly. And I also think that, you know, I mean, and going to teachers' unions, which I'm not always a fan of, right, is this idea that, you know, that one size fits all, specifically related to education, is a highly problematic paradigm, right? What we really need to do is figure out, you know, like, certain kids learn certain ways, certain kids learn other ways. How can we, you know, devise, you know, a system or a set of systems that can really bring out, you know, the intellectual curiosity of a child, right?
Or, and it's, I mean, it's not even really bring it out. I mean, it's already there. Like, that's but it's nurturing it and, you know, challenging it so that, you know, the intellectual curiosity is broadened, right?
Certainly.
Yeah.
But I think we also have a lot of data to suggest, and, you know, I mean, data is what data is, right? That, you know, the more kids are exposed to various words, right? Like, the number of words that kids are exposed to before the age of five, right? Before they actually go off to kindergarten,
right,
is, you know, crucial in terms of, like, long-term and short-term success and the ability to express themselves and the ability, I mean, even to do well on tests that are problematic, like the SAT or the GRE or whatever. You know, you have any number of these type of tests. And I think the difficulty to me is that, you know, exactly how much can you legislate, right? And what I say by this is that, you know, if we know, right, that so much is in terms of, like, a child's chances in life can be determined between the time they're in the womb, right, to age five, then it's a problem that we're only getting into the, you know, that they're only getting into a system at age five, right? I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about Finland, and I had a former student who studied abroad there, was she talked about how the Finns have a baby box that if you, when you get pregnant, right, if you get pregnant, you probably won't, but you never know.
Well,
anything's possible, right? But suffice it to say, if you get pregnant, if a woman gets pregnant, one of the things she gets as she's getting closer to her due date is a big baby box. And this baby box, you know, includes all sorts of resources for her, like, I mean, books on, like, you know, raising babies, you know, like, some formula and this or that. It also includes the box itself. This is one thing that I found very interesting. The box itself has a small mattress at the bottom and can actually double as a crib if you cannot afford a crib.
That's great. Right?
Yeah. So what you get is you get a good, you know, I mean, what, imagine if American mothers had a good start, right? Before they got, before they even had the baby, they had, you know, a community that supported them and provided them with this good, right? So, which seems remarkably civilized, but it also seems to be something where it's like, you know, that women who are having babies will be supported. Right. Which sounds lovely to me, but yet I can't see it ever passing in this country. Right. Like, that there's kind of legislation that you could actually put into place. Right. That would benefit, you know, children from the very get go and not, you know, kind of public school once you hit age five. Right. Because there's a lot that happens before age five.
But I think that's, I mean, you know, this is also part of what Brian and I talked about, is that essentially, you know, the I 100%, you know, morally understand that argument.
Sure.
And essentially what has happened, though, is that the narratives that have been structured by the Republican and the Democratic parties, mm-hmm. they're basically arguing between two things that we can all agree on, mm-hmm. right? The Democrats are arguing that you should help the less fortunate, mm-hmm. and the Republicans are arguing that you shouldn't steal, right? That's the way that they've framed their arguments.
Okay. And, okay. And, I mean, I'm not sure if I've.
I agree. I understand, right? But uh-huh. but what I'm saying is these are how the narratives have been framed.
Certainly.
And so therefore, everything becomes there's no real conversation that's happened, and we're not really acting. I mean, in terms of, you know, blues versus greens and blues versus red, mm-hmm. we're not actually sitting around and trying to figure out how do you solve problems, what actually works, and all of that sort of stuff. It's really just about having some sort of narrative that you can pitch to your followers that makes it seem like you are going to solve all of their problems and the other people are the devil, rather than trying to actually figure out, you know, what are the best policies? Let's see if we can refine this. We all recognize the whole success of Silicon Valley or, mm-hmm. you know, the FAA is mm-hmm. based on a culture of mistakes, a willingness to get things wrong and a willingness to get willingness to learn. Mm-hmm. But there's such a hostility towards the idea that candidates might change their mind or mm-hmm. that,
oh,
you
certainly.
Know.
And if you do, then, you know, you're a flip-flopper.
Exactly.
Right. As opposed to someone who might, whose like views might have been persuaded by, you know, quality arguments.
Or new data might have arisen.
Yes.
For example, you know, during the Bush administration, new data arose and maybe we should have changed our policies at some point along the way.
One could only wish.
Yeah. But my larger point, and okay. to go back to the beginning of all of this, mm-hmm. is that I think that we do ourselves a tremendous disservice in buying into either of the narratives that either of the parties advance, because we end up pitted at each other's necks,
well,
and then, which is a horrible turn of phrase, but
what I would
know.
Say is this, right? You know, the hypocrisy is abound, right? I offer the example of Barbara Boxer, who, you know, one of the most liberal, you know, senators, mm-hmm. and you know, I highly support her in most of her endeavors. You know, but does she spend much time in the inner city? No, right? Like, now, does she vote? Well, sure. But, like, there's a difficulty there in terms of kind of a disconnect between her mm-hmm. and, like, minority communities. But simultaneously, what you also see is, I mean, you see these Republicans who are, I don't think it's don't steal. I think it's more, you know, don't do crime, right, first off. But I also think it's more of, like, you know, no new taxes. Right.
Well,
like, I think that's a key component.
I think I was unclear. When I said don't steal, what I mean is that they're framing, you know, any sort of redistribution of wealth by the government as taking from hardworking people and giving
exactly.
it to people who don't work. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean by don't steal.
Sure.
Right. I don't mean particularly in a sort of criminal punishment way. And that's
okay,
obviously.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And that you know, that's reductionist, you know, but just to try and, you know, the moral impulses that they're speaking mm-hmm. to on both sides are perfectly understandable.
Mm-hmm. No, because, okay, now I have a better sense
yeah,
of what you were
I'm
saying.
I'm sorry, that was unclear.
No worries. But what I think about it is that, you know, on the one hand, right, you know, Republicans have supported any number of policies that do not benefit hardworking people, right? And what I mean by this is, you know, there's a great book by Suzanne Mettler. She teaches at Cornell University. She's a brilliant political scientist in their Department of Government. And she wrote this book called The Submerged State. I think she published it with the University of Chicago Press. Came out about a year or two ago. And what she talks about is the fact that, you know, it's kind of an interesting answer to Romney's, you know, suggestion that, you know, you have this 47% who are just taking their intent upon, like, mooching off the government, basically. And what she argues is that, in fact, it's more like 96%, right? That when you look at the policies that, you know, especially policies that have been, you know, enacted by Republicans, mm-hmm. right? You know, the fact that realistically, many of the policies actually disproportionately benefit the wealthy, right, who are not hardworking, they don't necessarily need to be hardworking, but more that when you look at the tax policies that disproportionately benefit money that makes money, as opposed to people who are hardworking Americans who are out there working every day, at least 9 to 5, if not much, mm-hmm. much more, right, that work, you know, does not get the same kind of tax relief as money that's just simply sitting there making more money, mm-hmm. right? So it's kind of this interesting dynamic because I can understand, you know, so I mean, I can completely understand the idea of like hardworking Americans who, you know, don't want more and more money taken out of their paychecks.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me, you know, like it's not like I want all sorts of money taken out of my paycheck. No, I don't. I really don't. It would be nice if I didn't, but whatever. That said, right, that's kind of it's a contradiction only because when you look at the policies that are actually put in place, what you see is a disproportionate amount of fiscal policies designed by Republicans that disproportionately benefit the already wealthy and the super wealthy, right? So this is not about the hardworking Americans. I think Democrats would say, yes, we want relief for, you know, for all the struggling families out there and the hardworking Americans who are just trying to make ends meet, right? But the question is, you know, can you create policies that actively do that when, you know, when I would argue the Republican leadership obstructs that end?
But can you...
They talk a good game, but they obstruct.
Well, of course, but I think that's the thing. The Democrats also talk a good game.
Oh, certainly.
And so but that's the point, is at what point, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, you're a true believer. You believe in, I mean, more or less, but, you mm-hmm. know, your faith in the Democratic Party is far deeper than mine.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point, I think, do Americans have to say to themselves, you know, yes, we've been, the narrative that has been framed for us for so long is that you should vote for the least bad candidate. You know, mm-hmm. there are problems with our
sure.
candidate, but the other candidate is so much worse. And at what point do we realize that we shouldn't be satisfied with either candidate because neither candidate is particularly good and that we need root and branch reform, that we need to fix campaign finance, we need to, you know, whatever those policies are, make government smaller. That's generally the conservative argument mm-hmm. to campaign finance and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But at what point do we actually need to step back from both red and blue and start to rethink from the ground up the sorts of changes that might need to happen?
I mean, and I want to be very clear here. There's a structural impediment to creating third parties, right? We know this.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest problem. Like, if I mean, were it up to me, there would be multiple political parties, not simply two,
mm-hmm.
right? Two dominant parties. Moreover, that we could have the kind of proportional representation that would allow for those persons running from those parties to get elected, right? I mean, I highly question it in various instances, both parties, right? Both the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, and I've witnessed plenty of behind the scenes moments that shape my views, right? So I don't know that. I think that individuals have many failings, right? And in so doing, that the poor oftentimes by both parties can be seen as collateral,
mm-hmm.
right? That you know, they're basically electorally captured. They're you know, nobody is really articulating their needs, right, in any major way, right? You might talk about the need for increased minimum wage. That's great, right? But how about if we start talking about affordable daycare? How about if we start talking about all these things? So I would support third parties. I would support, you know, proportional representation. I think that the entire structure needs to change, right? But again, what you have is you have these institutions, being these two parties, who will do whatever they want. It will, like, collude to make sure that, you know, that upstarts don't succeed.
Right.
Right. And I think the other part that's hard about the way the parties work right now is that if you participate in a third party, it actually hurts, you know, one of the two dominant parties that you're closest to.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the biggest problem here. So they're, I mean, they've basically held a monopoly on this system, right? And they like, I mean, institutions, remember, they're there to protect their own interests.
Of course.
Right? They are there to protect the institution first, like the individuals who run the institution second, and a distant third, right, I would argue would be like the American people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of a larger global community, right? So all of these interests, right? Are it's almost like they have to conform to these institutions in one form or another, right? And that's highly, highly problematic. And both parties are neck deep in this entrenched system.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is, rather than us pretending that it's about Republican versus Democrat, mm-hmm. and we're either Republican and think the Democrats are worse, or the Democrats are good and the Republicans are worse, mm-hmm. that we need to realize that the two-party system is the fundamental problem, and that we need to step back from that, and that, you know, we all, whatever, because whether you're a libertarian or whether you're, you know, would be a Green Party voter or whatever it is that you would like to vote for, or some new party that you're going to create, that fundamentally the two-party system is the enemy of the people having the kind of representation that they really, really want.
The quality of representation.
That's right.
That they really, really want. Because right now, you know, when you're deciding between the lesser of two evils, that is not a reflection of the kind of quality that you need.
Exactly.
Right? And I completely agree with you. I think the two-party system, I mean, I don't want to say that the two-party system is the only part of the problem, right?
No.
But what I will say is that it is the rules of the game as it exists right now, mm-hmm. that is dictating such problematic outcomes, as well as, you know, the disaffection of the American populace,
mm-hmm.
right? When you look at the voting statistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
People don't show up to the polls. They especially don't show up to the polls during a midterm election. This makes me very, very sad. But what you also see is
But there's a reason why people don't show up to the polls. I think that's the thing is, I think, listen, voter apathy is incredibly justified.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And I feel like the parties aren't working hard enough, right? And I think that there should be more parties. I mean, why is it that the United States is, I mean, and we've seen this basically since the dawning of you know, this country, right? That we are so stuck in this model of two parties and majority rule, winner take all, as opposed to, you know, politics where you can have shared power, shared responsibility, right? And actually, you know, have a system that encourages collaboration, you know, not collusion.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't see that right now. We just don't. And
well, but I think that's the thing is, I think that that's because the parties have done such a good job of creating their respective narratives. The Democrats keep their supporters focused on the Republicans, and the mm-hmm. Republicans keep their voters focused on the Democrats, and they label anybody with any sort of alternative opinion as a whack job.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody gets written off as a social, you know, you're a communist, you're a socialist, you're palling around with Hitler.
And or the libertarians, I mean, they get written off too. I mean, everybody across the political spectrum gets written off as sort of wacky.
Yeah.
And I think that part of it is that, you know, those people, again, they get forced to be that much more extreme to try and set themselves apart.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you actually had some political competition, which mm-hmm. there is no political competition now, really, it's this sort of very narrow, narrow competition. It's not even an oligopoly.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's really, it's two power brokers just sort of passing the baton back and forth. If you had genuine political competition, you know, I think the conversation would change. A lot of things would change.
So do I.
Yeah. And I think part of what I'm realizing as well, and in large part thanks to talking to people like you.
Oh, thank you.
Is the fact that, you know, when I read Republic Lost, it really clarifies a lot of the problems. But having talked to people on the more conservative side of the spectrum, you know, they have a real problem with any sort of public financing or anything like that. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it may be that the next step, the thing that we can actually all rally behind, is electoral reform such that, you know, there can be more competition, more opportunity for third parties, that you can do things like that, because you have parties you would like to see exist. They have parties they would like to see exist. And so be it.
Well, I mean, I think I remember interviewing members of Congress for my dissertation, and I interviewed a number of moderate Republicans, right,
mm-hmm.
from various states across the country. But, you know, they're a dying breed, right? Like, and talking to this one man, I'm not going to say what state he was from, only because that would probably give it away. Talking to this one man, you know, seasoned politician, wise, you know, very, very I mean, he very, very responsible in his actions, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't play on the politics of fear, didn't play on the politics of hate or mm-hmm. anything like that. He was, you know, just very astute. But he was getting run out of his own party, right? And you sat there and he talked about how, you know, this moderate Republican, he talked about how, you know, the best situation for him at least would be if the Democrats or the Republicans had at least had roughly a 3-vote difference in Congress, in the House of Representatives, because that was the only way that either one of them would be reasonable. Now, what was interesting is that he actually thought that he would prefer the Democrats to be in charge, because then, you know, because the Republicans were the ones who were like, you know, kind of, you know, at the time it was like Tom DeLay and, you know, that crowd who were basically the ones running him out of his seat.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And eventually he lost in a primary, right, to a very, very conservative, staunch conservative Republican, right, who, you know, lacked the wisdom and the know-how, right, that this man had. I mean, you looked at him and you're like, wow, you know, this is this person who's so incredibly thoughtful, very astute, you know, fiscally conservative, but with an understanding of trying to make quality policy that worked for everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? Socially moderate, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, this was kind of the kind of person that I would actually want to see in Congress.
Right.
Being run out by his own party, right? Because
but being run out, I think, more specifically by the incentive structure.
Exactly.
The combination
yes.
of, you know, a two-party system and, you know, campaign finance and all of these sorts of things, it selects for a certain kind of candidate.
Certainly. And like I said, if these parties are like cartels, the cartel was running at him out of business for not being cartelish enough.
Well,
right.
Absolutely. And in fact, they didn't even have to run him out of business. I think that's the whole point, is just that naturally the system selected him out, right? You get a more extreme candidate who's willing to play more on fear and more on hate. That's a person who can make people emotional.
Certainly.
If you can make people emotional, you can get them to give more money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get them to give more money, then ultimately, you know, you're going to end up beating
but
the person.
But he also, even though this was, you know, had this man had served probably 6 terms and was an incumbent, was not receiving the kind of party support that others
of
had.
Of course. Because,
right?
But that's because they, I mean, you know, realistically, based on the incentive structure that
yeah.
we've given these people, it
mm-hmm.
makes sense that they would do that.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, we, I think as whatever, you know, maybe on our voter registration card, I think that we all need to start to recognize that the incentive structure that is being set up in terms of elections is really not serving anyone. And so we really have to step back from, I think, both narratives of Republican and Democrat and start to look at, you know, as a nation, what are the incentive structures that are going to serve the sort of outcomes that we want so that we can all be represented wherever we may lie on the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. But I think that the parties themselves need to be more willing to accept dissent, right? I mean, they
yeah, but
like
are they? I mean, you know, a person does what their paycheck encourages them to do under the
granted.
current incentive scheme. What is that the incentives that they're being
mm-hmm.
rewarded for? You
mm-hmm.
know, you don't get on the news for saying something moderate. You know, that we had Justin Guest on who wrote this book about, you know, alienated Muslims in the
yeah.
West, and
mm-hmm.
he was saying, there's this imam in London. He has this tiny, tiny following, like
mm-hmm.
5 or 10. I mean, like, I don't remember what the numbers are, but it's very,
sure.
very small. And the guy literally has a hook and an eye patch. He has a missing eye and an eye patch, and he has a missing hand, and he has a hook. And he comes out, and this imam says the craziest shit possible, you know, just about how, like, you know, we're all going to burn and die, you know, there's going to be whatever it is. And, of course, every time this guy thinks of something more ludicrous to say, he gets in the newspapers. But
mm-hmm.
he doesn't, you know, moderate imams are boring, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They say, hey guys, peace and love, you know, I know we have some differences, let's try and work through them. You know, that's not what makes the news. And by the same token, if you're either a Republican or a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to get in the news, you're not going to get headlines, you're not going to become a party leader if you're coming out and saying moderate, reasonable, responsible things.
Certainly. I mean, and then the question is, like, Or at least, you know, if you're not part of an event, like, I mean, and I say this because we've seen all sorts of studies of, or, you know, and books written about the fact that, you know, you have disproportionate number of athletes, mm-hmm. astronauts. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of like compared to the number of persons in the actual American population, right? You know, the people who, you know, tend to ascend, right, in one way or another, on average, tend to be people who have excelled elsewhere. Right. Or have stood out elsewhere. And what does that really say? Right. Like that you need to be famous first. So you already have name recognition. So then you can get in. Right. I don't know. I mean, what if the most boring person in the world is the best person for the job? Right. And I'm not necessarily advocating boring. Right. But I am saying that, like, that may be the very case. And yet, you know, like, I mean, I fear the day that, like, somebody like Kim Kardashian gets elected to something. Right.
I think that day under the current system, that sort of thing is 100% possible.
I know. Right. I mean, like, that it's like, OK, I'm going to make myself famous. I'm going to make a sex tape. It's going to be awesome.
But by the same token. I mean, assuming that Kim Kardashian was just the figurehead, if mm-hmm. what was happening behind the scenes was that she had the most amazing staffers and everything else, and, you know, they were writing great bills and those great bills were being passed, then that would be awesome. Like, who cares who the figurehead is? But in practice, that's not what's happening, because the behind the scenes, the bills are being written by the special interests, wherever they may be, and the policies are being shaped. I mean, Barbara Boxer's decisions probably weren't really shaped by Barbara Boxer.
I don't know. I mean, I have to add, and this is something that, you know, I don't want to get away from. So, you know, so before she was elected to the House, right, my understanding is that she was on the Marin County, you know, Board of Supervisors or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I will say this. She has been a long time proponent of environmental issues. Right.
Sure.
And has actually, like, in many cases, kind of stood up to the big money. I mean, because the environment doesn't necessarily, like, pro-environmental causes don't necessarily have anywhere near the kinds of cash as, like, big oil and, like, fossil fuels. They don't,
yeah,
right?
I don't think there's any question
okay,
about that.
Okay, yeah, right. So when you're, you know, so when she's one of the early, one of the earlier environmentalists elected to, you know, the House and then the Senate, right, that does say something, right? That, I mean,
well, it does, but at the same token, I mean, you know, how much courage does it require to be a Democrat who's pro-environment?
These days?
Well, I think that's the thing, you've talked about...
I mean, I think at the time it was novel. Now...
But it's, again, like, so much of it is narratives. I think it's always interesting to look at what charities celebrities support.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. They okay, all, granted.
You know, it's like, oh, I mean, I went to the Miss America pageant. I had a friend of mine from college was Miss Rhode Island.
Oh,
and
dear.
I went to the Miss America pageant, and it was simultaneously the most entertaining and the most boring thing I have ever attended. It was amazing. But what was really interesting about all of the causes was they took some issue and then made it in children. So mm-hmm. you take it, and I mean, it was so extreme that there was, I don't remember what state she was from, but there was some woman who was talking about sudden cardiac arrest in children. Like, that was her cause. And, you know, I mean, sure, children having heart attacks, and she was talking about kindergartners. Children having a kindergartner having a heart attack would be a tragic thing. I would like to know how many times it has happened.
Right.
And should we really, as she suggested, be installing defibrillators in every single kindergarten? I don't know that that's the number one priority. But
wow.
But in the same way, you know, celebrities choose charities that, you know,
certainly.
There are certain charities that are popular. There are certain, you know.
But what I want to say is this, is that in 1992, you know, when she the first time she ran for the Senate, right, it was not the de rigueur. It was not the news of the day, right? Like, you did
Captain
not have...
Planet was on, I'd like to point out.
Okay, sure. And you had Smokey the Bear as well. I like Smokey the Bear. But when you think about, like, you know, the kind of heft that people like Leonardo DiCaprio have, like, you know, offered to climate change. So, you know, like, at the time, yes, the environment was...
In California, you know, it was among young kids, like 90s. That's like Captain Planet, I just checked, aired in 1990.
Certainly.
It was incredibly trendy. And listen, but I think...
I don't think it was. And I mean, I was here in California in the 1990s, right?
Well,
because I grew up here, right? Like, and I remember, I mean, the environment was one of the lower issues on the radar, right?
We but had, it's such a... I mean,
immigration was actually a very, very big
sure.
issue. Affirmative action was a very, very big issue.
But in terms
Pete
of,
Wilson was getting elected
but
governor.
In terms of who Barbara Boxer, this is Barbara Boxer was running for Congress or Senate at this point?
At that point in 92, she was it was her first Senate campaign.
And so she's running for her first Senate campaign, right?
Yeah.
And so essentially Barbara Boxer's base is San Francisco and
yeah.
then
yeah.
L.A., San Diego.
Sure.
I mean, you know, if anybody is going to be in favor of talking about environmental issues, that's sort of a pretty uncontroversial one. But that's, I mean, regardless, listen,
mm-hmm.
it's great that she did that. And,
yeah.
you know, props to Barb Boxer. But at the same time, again, like these narratives are being chosen that appeal to us. But
yeah.
all, you know, great, we focus on dolphins and whales. But in the meantime, the structure of our the structure of our government is set up to not represent our interests and to ensure
Certainly.
That special interests are in power. And I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, if we keep on arguing about Republican versus Democrat,
yeah.
then we're going to miss the we're going to spend our time doing that. I mean, you know, yesterday the people got pissed off enough with the Democrats that they're like, let's have more Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at some point they'll get pissed off, just as in 2008, they got pissed off with the Republicans and they said, let's have more Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But you're yo-yoing back and forth between these two options.
Brandon.
You're not getting the results that you wanted. And at what point do you realize that fundamentally both options are not really good enough? They
well,
one may be better than the other for you, but fundamentally both are broken and we really need to change the structure of how candidates are selected.
Oh, great. I mean, I completely, you know, you won't hear me disagreeing with you. I completely agree. I mean, and I think the thing is, though, is that how do you change the rules of the game, the structural rules of the game
mm-hmm.
to improve the process?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, and this is the interesting thing about, like, you know, about the United States is that, you know, like, if you want to change the rules of the game, well, the institutions are going to fight you tooth and nail. Right. They're going to, you know, fight you to the bone on that one. Right. Yeah. But it's interesting. There's, you know, even when you think about holding midterm elections in general,
mm-hmm.
well, you have lower turnout.
Mm-hmm.
So are midterm elections necessarily all that useful? Right. Or, you know, should we have elections just every 4 years, which when you have all so many more people turning out?
Right.
Right. I mean, if you want a good democracy, why aren't people focusing on changing the rules to make, you know, to increase the amount of turnout? Right.
100% agree.
I mean, and your platform can't be based upon the fact that you're trying to make sure that people don't turn out. Right. Like, that's a problem unto itself. Now, I mean, one thing that LA City Council is doing, and I think this is very interesting, is that they're actually, you know, voting on changing their schedule so that their schedule will coincide and not with midterm elections, but with, you know, with national presidential elections as a means to increase turnout.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like they're, you know, and so this is going through the process now. We'll see if it actually like officially gets the thumbs up for LA City Council. But I think it's a great idea. Right. That if you have, you know, like city council held, you'll have greater turnout. You'll have higher quality in terms of, you know, at least people having a say in who's representing them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the other thing is that we really do have to get back to this notion of third parties. And it's not, you know, wacky, right? It's not crazy to say that a third, you know, to have a system with multiple parties, right, will better serve the interests of the American public.
And that's my point is I think yeah. that I don't know that you're going to find anyone who thinks that setting up the system to encourage third parties, whatever those third parties may be, is a wacky idea. So
mm-hmm.
why don't we do that? Like, do we need a constitutional amendment? What do we need?
Well, I mean, but you... If you look at American history, I mean, it has been the case that people think it is a, you know, that third parties get dismissed, as wacky, as crazy, as stupid, right? I mean, even when you look at the rise of the Populist Party, you know, in the 1880s and 1890s, right? Like, they were ridiculed into despair, right? I mean, so...
But is that not also, I mean, that's the thing, right? You're talking about, you know, the structure of mm-hmm. the elections. Like, if the structure of the elections was different, mm-hmm. don't you think that we would have a different response to those third parties?
Yes.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Do we need a constitutional amendment that restructures how we elect candidates? And then we can all, you know, as a nation, try and figure out what is the best structure. We can look at different structures. We can figure out what is the structure that is going to serve, you know, the most representative, the mm-hmm. most exciting, engaging, dynamic, you know, range of political possibilities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that I would definitely argue for, I mean, I think California has actually done a good job, mm-hmm. right? One of the things that they did do is they changed the way of the voting structure so that instead of the top Democrat and this top Republican in the primary, they just said the top two regardless of party.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that was actually, I mean, that was a step in the right direction. Right. But I also think that you might, you know, if you want to stay with a geographic district model, which I don't know that we do, mm-hmm. but if you want to stay with a geographic district model, the idea of multi-member districts, right, that could be, you know, kind of allocated proportionally would be one way to go. People would, you know, be required within a district to share power.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because we haven't seen that so far. Right now we have a winner take all system. And that is what, you know, contributes to this two party system.
Right. I think that's, you know, in talking to you, and this was not something that was really formalized for me, but that there are so many other options and that we should be looking at all those other options, and that this is a nonpartisan issue. Because what I've come to realize is that to some extent, you know, campaign finance ends up being a partisan issue, because if you're talking about public allocation of financing, well, there's a whole lot of people that won't be on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me legitimately that restructuring elections at a national level, not just these sort of like local experiments of, you know, that Los Angeles is doing, but at a real national level in terms of how we elect congressmen and senators and presidents, there's a real possibility there for broad national support for something like that.
But I do want to say, with public financing, and this is the thing that always, you know, it's really interesting to me how it gets framed versus the actuality of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is this, right? And, you know, if you file your taxes, you know, by April 15th, there's a mm-hmm. little box, right, towards the top that says, do you want $3 of your taxes to go towards public financing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always check the box, right? Sure. $3 of taxes that I would already be paying,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not saying that, like, all of a sudden you're going to be taxed extra to support campaigns, right? This is just stuff that you're already paying. Do you just want it to go into the public financing pot, right? And it's $3, right? This is not like something...
Well, I think the Republican argument would be that once you open the door to public financing of elections, or, you know, open it further,
sure.
then inevitably the response will be, well, these things exist now. You know, once a public program is created, it never goes away, and therefore you have to raise taxes to cover that. So, you know, I mean, I think that's, I'm not saying that that logic is right or wrong. I'm
Certainly.
Just saying that that is the logic.
The counter argument.
Exactly. And that we inevitably end up having that same old argument that we always have between, you know, more government, less government, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Whereas I think the opportunity that exists with having some sort of restructure of the way that elections are done to encourage, you know, more political parties rather than just the same old two parties that aren't very satisfying to either side,
mm-hmm.
is that that's something that people can broadly get behind.
Certainly.
And
okay.
maybe I'm wrong, but I certainly think that it's something that's definitely worth exploring. And I think we should explore that. And I mean that legitimately. I mean, there must be organizations that are already trying to do this, right?
Well, I think one of the there are any number of, like, you know, nonprofits and think tanks that look at research that, like, mm-hmm. want to see, like, you know, types of systems, structures and stuff like that. One thing I want to say is that, you know, at least in terms of, like, the prospects of good government, I do, you know, a fair amount of, I'm a member of the League of Women Voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which is a nonpartisan entity, right, that you know, focuses largely on education of and information for voters,
mm-hmm.
right? And more importantly, not misinformation for voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because voters these days are inundated with, you know, completely misleading and or highly problematic and borderline illegal, right, flyers and mailers and information pieces provided. The League of Women Voters, at least, has been very determined to provide, you know, not to offer necessarily recommendations, right, but to provide quality analysis in terms of what types of, you know, what pieces of legislation or propositions, particularly in the state of California, as well as, you know, kind of like the platforms, you know, non-biased like assessments of the platforms of individual candidates. And I really wish, I mean, and again, this goes back to kind of the boring issue, right? People would rather watch, you know, I don't know, CNN, well, maybe not CNN, nobody watches CNN anymore, but like, you know, they'll watch MSNBC or Fox News as opposed to PBS NewsHour. Similarly, when you're
But I think with good reason. I mean, coming from the education perspective, you know, I think it's very interesting to contrast, you know, education and media, right?
Yeah.
Games, television, all of that sort of stuff, because educators, you know, are competing for children's attention,
mm-hmm.
but they don't really engage in that competition generally. Mostly, mm-hmm. they just sort of take it for granted that you should pay attention. And then mm-hmm. I can do whatever I want on my end. And if you're not paying attention, well, that's your failure.
Okay.
Whereas games companies and TV know they don't have that luxury. They understand and are constantly putting the responsibility on themselves to capture your attention. Now, they're totally agnostic about what it is that they put up in order to capture that attention.
Okay.
They'll do literally anything, but
yeah.
You know what there needs to be, I think, ideally media would be more conscientious about what it is that it's using to capture your attention, but then
certainly.
By the same token, you know, the people who are focused on disseminating certain information, they don't really think that hard about how to capture your attention or how to make it engaging or anything like that.
I mean, I think the thing, I mean, and I think it goes down to individuals, right? Because some individuals, depending upon leadership of a given institution, given organization, what have you, right, will do much more by way of outreach in order to try to talk to people about the, you know, about the issues, about analysis, right? With the hope that you were providing quality information, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the League of Women Voters for Los Angeles County had a voter guide, right? I made
mm-hmm.
sure that every single one of my students had, you know, could have a copy of this voter guide if they wanted it,
mm-hmm.
right? Which just gave, you know, the information, right?
Mm-hmm.
But most of them hadn't really even heard of the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, but right? Is that not also partly the failure of the League of Women Voters to not market themselves and to make themselves more engaging and more exciting? I recently read this book, Contagious, by Jonah Berger, and we're going to get him on. And it's basically about why things go viral and why they stick. And, you know, it's all based on the dictates of human psychology. Like,
yeah.
Movember...
the mustache thing? Are
yeah,
you growing
absolutely.
A mustache under?
No. you know, but that's because I have combination skin. But Movember is brilliant because,
yeah,
you know, that's,
totally.
But that's, I mean, you know, that's a sort of really smart messaging, or the ALS Ice Bucket
the
Challenge.
Ice Bucket
exactly.
Challenge,
exactly.
Yes.
So, you know, these are really, really smart, smart programs that are done from a nonprofit standpoint that really understand human psychology, understand what we respond to.
Mm-hmm.
And the tendency with things like the League of Women Voters or education or any of these sorts of things where there's information that we know you should have, and
yeah.
it's a very rational approach to the problem without understanding the emotional part, the human psychology, and figuring out how do we capture your attention? How
mm-hmm.
do we make it so that you get so excited about this that you share it? You know, the mm-hmm. LiveStrong bracelets is another example that's given.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which, oh. yeah, I mean, you know, obviously Lance Armstrong is complicated, but
yes.
the LiveStrong bracelets were hugely effective and very successful. And, you know, there were a lot of smart things that they did. For example, choosing the color yellow,
yep.
because yellow is very visible. It's
mm-hmm.
a color that doesn't have strong associations for most people in the West,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think that's the thing is in terms of edutainment,
mm-hmm.
right? Entertainment is pure entertainment without any sort of educational value. And then, you know, educational materials tend to be purely educational. And it's this very rational delivery of the facts. And the problem is that we are primarily emotional creatures, and you need to structure the real creative and imaginative work consists in structuring that information in such a way that it grabs you emotionally and that it makes you engage with it. And I mean, I think that's the thing is that, again, there's a tendency always to blame, like we look at voter apathy and it's very easy to say, oh, it's the voter's fault. The voter is bad. But, you know, I think that's the thing. The voter is responding to what's being offered to them. And in the same way, oh, people don't know about the League of Women Voters. Well, you can blame the citizen again, but also...
No, I mean, I'm certainly not blaming the citizen. Yeah. But what I would argue is that, you know, like, it's very hard with particularly with nonprofits and, you know, like, and what have you, to raise the kind of money that, you know, to provide unbiased information to an electorate, right? Right now, it seems to be overwhelmed with biased information, right? So the question is, you know, like kind of how do you reach? I mean, other than have a professor with a class of like 130 students.
But I think that's what's interesting about this book, Contagious, is that his point is that, you know, really effective messaging is not about money. It's about creativity, and it's about using what we know about human psychology to package this stuff. One of the great stories that he gives is the example of BlendTech.
Okay.
You know, the Will It Blend videos. Mm. And those videos, I mean, they basically had invented this blender that was, you know, incredibly powerful. And the guy had hired one of his friends as the marketing budget.
Certainly.
The marketing guy for him. And so he's sitting around and he's just, you know, putting planks of wood in there and golf balls and whatever other weird things. Because the inventor of BlendTech is really just focused on making sure that the machine doesn't break, trying to make it as tough as possible, seeing what goes wrong. And the marketing guy sees an opportunity. He sees that, oh, we can do a series of YouTube videos where you blend different things and it'll show the power of the video, show the power of the device.
Yeah.
That costs, and I don't remember what the amount of money is, but hundreds of dollars, you know, and it's a hugely successful campaign.
Yeah.
But the reason why it's hugely successful is not because resource or money is spent, but because it shows it's really designed for the sort of stories that humans love to share. People watch those videos. They're like, oh, my God, will it blend this thing? It did. It just blended a whole thing of marbles.
Okay.
That's amazing. Let me share that with my friend. You know, and so that desire for sharing and all that sort of stuff, I think we do ourselves a tremendous disservice to pretend that resources is everything.
Yeah.
Resources is
Grant,
everything.
Yeah.
Children is our future. But I think we do ourselves a tremendous disservice. And I think a large part of it is, you know, imagination, ingenuity, really thinking about all of these things. And yeah, I think my larger point is that, you know, we've been fed these narratives for so long by both parties.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative of resources, the narrative of, you know, the fact that the other party is bad and our party is good. And we don't realize that we need to step back from both of those parties and start to wonder.
Or, I mean, I think many people do realize that they want to step back from both of those parties. They just don't have, you know, third party options, and they don't have, you know, and they don't have. There are consequences right now to third-party options, whereas there are incentives to, like, staying within, conforming to a two-party system.
So here's what I'm really asking you.
Okay.
Why we need to either, maybe the movement already exists, but I think part of it is that we need to figure out a movement for electoral reform so that, you know, things are structured in such a way that it serves third-party candidates.
Well, I think, you know, the person who, you know, maybe you should best talk to is Lonnie Guinier at Harvard Law School. I mean, and a handful of others. Like, I mean, there are a lot of, I think there are a lot of law professors who are definitely down for the cause.
Great.
The issue, however, becomes, remember, like Lonnie had advocated, you know, kind of like proportional representation in various ways. I use her book, Tyranny of the Majority, in most of my classes. And she was pilloried when she was nominated by Bill Clinton to serve as, you know, the chief of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because she was thinking outside of the box.
Right.
She was right. She was always right. And she's brilliant. But she, you know, in many ways, she was ahead of her time. Mm-hmm. And the question is, like, how do we create the white time to make the to sustain it, right? Well, so it's not just the like getting the movement people. It's about making sure that we have the kind of institutional support to where, you know, certain people aren't thrown under the bus.
But I think it's not just institutional support. I think that's the point. It's hearts and minds.
Exactly.
Agreed. It's creating narratives. It's all of that sort of stuff where, you know, you message and you brand this stuff in the right way, mm-hmm. and particularly so that you're not, you know, making this a partisan issue, which I think is the danger of campaign finance. You know, all power to Larry Lessig, but I think it's going to end up being framed as a partisan issue. I mean, to a certain extent, it already is.
Yep.
And I think there's the opportunity that, you know, electoral reform to encourage third-party candidates doesn't necessarily need to be, because there are a lot of people across the political spectrum who feel like neither of the two cookie-cutter options represents their needs. I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find anyone in this country who really feels that either the Republican or the Democratic Party truly reflects what they want to see happen.
Yeah. And I mean, and that will also require that, I mean, as a byproduct, that the two parties up their game.
Absolutely, which I think is the best part of it.
Yeah.
It's who the Democrats and the Republicans will become once there is actual competition.
Yeah.
They will actually become the good parties that they are both capable of being.
Exactly. Agreed.
Great. I think that's the end. Oh, yeah. The mutiny is now over. Brian Callen is once again our benevolent dictator.
There you go.
And, you know, all other names would be whispered from now on. All hail Brian Callen.
All right. Our God. Okay.
Our God.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.